As to our speaker of the evening, of the afternoon, he is presently executive director of the New York City Alcoholics Information Center. The center is sponsored by the National Committee of Alcoholism. He has lectured since 1947 for nearly 10 years now throughout the United States on this baffling question of alcoholism. He has taken part in seminars conducted by leading colleges and universities of this country on the various phases of alcoholism. He has taught in some of the leading colleges of this country the subject of sociology. He is a graduate of, I believe, three colleges, three colleges, and will soon have his doctorate degree in sociology from a leading college. He certainly is not like the guest speaker last night, Julian, who said he never had any trouble with alcohol in high school or college because he never went to high school or college. Well, our speaker of the afternoon can't say that. Now, all the things I've said about our distinguished speaker, of course, well qualify him to be here speaking this afternoon. But as every member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this room knows, what really qualifies our speaker talk to us this afternoon is this fact. And Dennis, probably this fact alone, he is himself a member of the Washington Heights group of Alcoholics Anonymous of New York City. The Kentucky State Conference proudly presents Dennis M. of New York City. Dennis.
My name is Dennis Patrick McKinney. Believe it or not. And I am an alcoholic. Believe it, period. There's a rumor around that some of the people in this room used to frequent bars. If any of you used to wonder who the hell that little guy was down at the end of the bar, take a good look, because here I am. Alcoholic Best Pocket Edition. I don't want you to underestimate the little man down at the end of the bar. One of my favorite stories is about the days of the 49ers. Way out in the wild and woolly west, Two-Gun Pete went into the local saloon one day, fired off both of his sidearms, and said, "Every son of a bitch in the place, get the hell out of here." And they all did. Except the little guy down at the end of the bar. He went over to him and he said, "You heard what I said, didn't you?" The little fellow said, "Yes. Yes, I did. And my, weren't there a lot of them?" Introducing me, Carl said that I have degrees from three universities. I've taught in 11 of them. But he said what is most pertinent. The thing that qualifies me to be here this afternoon is that I am an alcoholic. You know, when universities want to honor a man who has his full share of degrees, they give him another one, and then in Latin, after that degree, they write, causa honoris, meaning that this degree is given for the sake of honor. And so in my professional work, I am introduced, and my degrees are read first. I always whisper to myself, the degree which God in his goodness and my fellow AAs have conferred upon me in the cause of honor. Dennis McGinty, AA, causa honoris. Now, I've talked long enough in AA and on public platforms to know anything you say can be used against you. So I want to say right away that anything I say this afternoon is pure McGinty. Only my own opinion. And I hope, and I pray to God, that nobody here hears what I'm saying, or even what I think I'm saying. But that somebody here hears something he or she needs to do. I want to say right off, I'm a ham. I can't help being a ham. If I tried to be anything else, I'd be a phony. In AA, we have no time for phony. So please accept me as the ham I am. I also want to warn you, as they say about me, you know, McGinty, your trouble isn't that it's the first word, drink. Your trouble is the first word, then I'm off. I remember the first time I talked to AA, 8 years ago, this month, in Washington, D.C., where I came in, I asked the young lady who asked me to speak, what'll I say? She said, oh, Dennis, just open your mouth and pour out the overflow of your mind. So now, for the next several minutes, while I pour out the overflow of my mind, you good people are privileged to listen to a drip. We've had a wonderful conference here the last 3 days. I've attended conferences all over the United States, AA meetings in several foreign countries. And I haven't attended anything any better. The variety, the depth, the simplicity and profundity of the things one hears as alcoholics speak to each other. You know, I think that's about as good a definition of AA as can be given. I have a priest friend of mine who told me he had a wedding at the church one day. That afternoon he went down to the neighborhood barbershop to get his hair cut, and the barber said to him, Father, you had a wedding over at the church today. You know, I used to know that young fellow that got married. He used to drink something terrible. Then he joined some kind of an outfit. All they do is talk, and he's never had a drink since. Look at this room. Handsome people. And I stand here. But I'll bet lots of you who sit there are wondering, in this room, open to the public, which ones are the drunks? You know, that's important. They used to tell a story at the Yale School of Alcohol Studies, and I was there about 8 years ago. You know, to that summer school of alcohol studies, there come authorities on alcoholism from all over the world, psychiatrists, psychiatric social workers, sociologists like myself, judges, lawyers, doctors, internists, clergymen, and there come as students, sociologists, psychiatric social workers, psychiatrists, doctors, lawyers, judges, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, representatives of the distilleries and breweries, representatives of the temperance league. The great and reassuring thing to me when I attended was that if each authority on alcoholism or the alcoholic concluded his remarks at the podium to that group who were there, he ended up by saying, "This is what I know about alcoholism. This is what I know about alcoholics. But after I've told you what I know, and after I've done for you what I can do, if you are an alcoholic, the thing I say to you is go to AA, every one of them." Well, they tell the story about the lady who represented the temperance league from somewhere up in one of the western provinces of Canada. And she came to the school, and after she'd been assigned her room in the dormitory there where we all lived, changed her frock, touched up her lovely white hair, she decided I'd better make a few acquaintances among these people with whom I'm going to spend the next several weeks. So she went out and she picked another lovely white-haired lady, and she went over and introduced herself. She says, "I'm Mrs. So-and-so from Saskatchewan. I have a rose garden. I represent the Temperance League. Who, my dear, are you?" The lovely white-haired lady said, "Oh, I'm Mrs. So-and-so, alcoholic." Horrified, she scuttled away. She picked another lovely white-haired lady, and she went over and said, "I'm Mrs. So-and-so, Saskatchewan, Rose Garden, Temperance League. Who, my dear, are you?" The second lovely white-haired lady said, "Oh, I'm Mrs. So-and-so, alcoholic." Again, she was horrified. Came to a friend of mine in the land of Georgia. And again, she repeated her formula, Saskatchewan, Rose Garden, Temperance League. "Who, my dear, are you?" My friend said, "Oh, I'm Betty B., land of Georgia, alcoholic." "I don't believe it. My dear, you've never been down and out." And Betty said, "As many of the people in this room could say this afternoon, oh, yes, I have. Way down. Way down." A clergyman friend of mine took a bishop to an annual dinner of Alcoholics Anonymous once. And the alcoholics came in with their husbands and wives and friends, everybody all dressed up. And the bishop looked at them, and he too wondered which ones are the drunks. And he said to the clergyman, "How do you tell which ones are the drunks?" And the clergyman answered, "Oh, that's easy. There. The happy one." I was down talk in the great Southwest. The big tri-state conference at AA a couple years ago. And a friend of mine, who's a banker in a little town out in Colorado, told me the story. It's true. He'd been a banker in Denver and kind of drank himself out of the business. So he went up to this little town. He thought he was the only alcoholic there, and he got looking around. He noticed that the CPA in town wasn't doing so good, so he went over and talked with him, and sure enough, he was one of the brothers, and they had a group. Pretty soon, one of the doctors in town came in, the local lawyer, the local ambulance driver. Finally, he told me a young fellow who was a doctor in town came to him to borrow what we call the big book. He had a patient. He thought maybe this was his problem. He took the book home, decided he'd read it himself first. And about halfway through, he slammed it shut and said to his wife, "That's my problem. I'm going to join." She said to him, "You're not an alcoholic. You're just a social climber." I tell you, we're in. Well, up there at Yale, one psychologist who came to the podium answered the $64,000 question. It used to be $64,000, but we got inflation now. He told us why we're alcoholics. He said we are alcoholics because we have poorly integrated personality. Now you know. It's as simple as that. But, he says, there are very, very few people, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, who have well-integrated personality. That's why I'm quoted as saying to people when they ask me if I'm an alcoholic, sure I'm an alcoholic. What's the matter with you? And that brings me to the thesis of what I have to say this afternoon. It is my contention that apart from the first drink, alcoholics are just like everybody else. I sometimes think that we alcoholics ourselves are the worst offenders at forgetting. Sometimes we think we're kind of special with our problems. Kind of hothouse flowers of sensitivity. But let's consider it a little. Before we do that, however, since we have guests here this afternoon who may not be too familiar with alcoholism and the alcoholic and the ideas with which we people live and have come to take for granted, I'd like to correct, or at least submit for your consideration, some alternatives to some of the ideas you may have in your mind as to what an alcoholic is. Certain stereotypes with which we've grown up, misconceptions that constitute the very stigma in our culture against the alcoholic. If you're like me, back in the days when at one of the major universities I was teaching a course in social pathology and discussing alcoholism, I always did it in terms of alcoholics and skid row, alcoholics and the indigent, alcoholics and the homeless, alcoholics and sex. Alcoholics and crime. Alcoholics and the organic psychosis. These things represent a small percentage of the problem of alcoholism at its most desperate end of the scale. I used to think an alcoholic was always a man. He was a skid row bum, asleep with papers inside his coat to cut the chilly wind in a forgotten doorway. He was somebody who just didn't care. He drank because he chose to drink. And I dare say this is pretty much the popular stereotype in the minds of the people of the United States today, albeit it is changing greatly, particularly since the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous, now the Al-Anon family group. How correct is it? Your own Louisville paper today, this Sunday, quoted a Gallup poll which says there are 102 million adults in the United States today. 40,800,000 of these people do not drink at all. 61,200,000 of them do drink. Of the 61,200,000, approximately 57 million some thousand, drink and have no trouble with their drinking. We who are concerned with alcoholism and the alcoholic are not concerned about these people. We're not concerned about the old problem of the wet and the dry, where the alcoholic was forgotten in the middle of this tug of war. We are concerned about the 4.5 million people in the United States who drink to excess, who suffer from the disease, the illness, the personality disorder of alcoholism. Out of 61 million, you might say, why only 4.5 million have this problem? Only 4.5 million. Name me another illness in the United States where there are 4.5 million in the United States. Cancer, diabetes, TB, name them all. Where do you have 4.5 million sufferers? And all too often forgotten. Forgotten by almost everybody. But their fellow sufferers. And for every alcoholic, it is estimated there are at least 4 others affected by their drinking. At least. That gives you about 18 million people who are victims of this illness. That's the proportion of this thing. Now, correction number 2. Of the 4.5 million, less than 15%, only about 12% are found on Skid Row. Where are the others? They are people in this room. They are in banks. They are in law. They are in industry. They are working in Macy's basement. They are stenographers in offices. They are housewives in homes. They live in the apartment next to you, the house across the street, the farm in the next 40. And they are hidden sufferers. 88% of alcoholics don't square with this stereotype of the Skid Row. Oh, sure, let it go on, this progressive disease, and they may end it. I know a clergyman who had been sent to several psychiatrists and pronounced psychotic by those psychiatrists. And their recommendation was permanent custodial care. And the fellow clergyman took him into AB. And today, he is the successful, brother-loving, and above all, happy pastor of one of the biggest churches in Brooklyn. I know another clergyman who was head of one of the biggest churches in New York City, Park Avenue Church, who landed on the Bower in Skid Row, came into AA, and today he's head of one of the most posh churches in the South. Is it any wonder we alcoholics say as we walk Skid Row, there but for the grace of God, go on. Does this square with your popular opinion of what is an alcoholic? Correction number 3. In this, our 4th national health problem, we say the alcoholic is a weak character. He has no character. This is the one I get sick and tired of. There isn't an alcoholic in this room who hasn't shown all kinds of strength of character and willpower. Oh, he showed it the wrong way. He was trying the wrong thing. But what he did took willpower. There isn't an alcoholic who didn't exert every ounce of intelligence and willpower he had, misguided, mistaken, to get out of the poisonous rat race of alcoholism. He hated himself. He was miserable. He was unhappy. He tried all kinds of things to get out of this problem. He changed from whiskey to beer, beer to wine. If he lived in the country, he moved to the city. If he lived in the city, he moved to the country. This is what we call a geographic treatment. He said, I'll take every other drink. I'll take every third drink. Time and again, he resolved, I'll never touch it again. And this did take willpower. And it took character to uproot yourself from the country to move to the city and start over. To uproot yourself from the city and move to the country and start over. That's the one where you say, what I need is fresh air and country milk. We've done these things. This took character and it took willpower. Sure, it wasn't the right thing to do. But it wasn't weak. It wasn't characterless. That's another fault. Now, correction number four. I think we need to distinguish in our minds among a drunkard, a heavy drinker, a social drinker, and an alcoholic. All four of these, and they're all different. We're inclined to think that all alcoholics are drunkards. We're inclined sometimes to think that heavy drinkers are alcoholics. And if we don't drink at all, we're inclined to think they're all the same thing. Now, I've already said 57 million people in the United States who drink are social drinkers. They can drink and it gives them no problem. 4.5 million who drink are drunkards, alcoholics, heavy drinkers. A drunkard just doesn't care. He could quit if he wanted to, but he just doesn't care. A heavy drinker can quit if he wants to. He goes on drinking heavily, and he can take it and work and deliver. The difference is that the alcoholic has to drink. He has to drink to go on living until something or somebody or some way of life helps him to stop. The alcoholic is marked by compulsive willing drinking, the loss of choice. Time and again he swears, I never will again. And time and again he goes back. Now then, even among alcoholics, we have to make some distinctions. As Carl has said this afternoon, among alcoholics there are a comparatively few who are what we call psychotic with alcoholism. There are others who are psychopathic personalities with alcoholism. The great majority of alcoholics are kind of anxiety alcoholics. And these are the ones that AA and its way of life help. Oh, psychiatrists have told me, even the psychotics, after some psychiatric counseling, can get along all right in AA. Not all of them, but some of them. With selective, careful selection, certain of the psychopathic personalities, with some psychiatric counseling, can get along all right in AA. We in AA are inclined to feel that the 25% who don't make the grade probably are this group. But as Carl has insisted, even they, if they believe, the rest of us AAs believe. in the omnipotence and the vitality of God's grace, may also find help. Too much nowadays in our secularized world, we're inclined to think that God is someone who abdicated or retired in the Middle Ages. And we have to look to something else for answers today. We in AA still believe in the vitality of the mercy and goodness of God. Well, for those corrections, let me go back to my thesis that apart from the first drink, alcoholics are pretty much just like everybody else. I would define an alcoholic as a person who is mentally, morally, and physically ill. It's an old, old illness. I'm an anthropologist. You know, in some of the societies of man, in his long million-year history on this earth, there were those in forgotten islands of the seas, forgotten forest places of time, where the alcoholic was a sort of demigod, a high priest. Why? Because he heard voices and he saw things nobody else did. Maybe we were just born out of our time. But this is true. When you go to Rome, look at the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's painting, there in Noah's flood is pictured the alcoholic trying to make it into a boat. Way back then. Hippocrates, father of medicine, used to give all of his patients, prescribe for all of his patients an alcoholic beverage because somehow it always made him feel better. And yet, Hippocrates 2,000 years ago said that what they called it then, drunkenness, was a kind of insanity. In the law courts of the Caesars, there is the record of a man brought before the judge for what they then called drunkenness. And the judge said, "This man is not a case for the law court. This man is a patient for the physician." 2,000 years ago. I believe I'm not wrong in saying that the first book on the illness of alcoholism was published in Europe in about 1543. Around 1800, over 150 years ago, a young man at the University of Edinburgh, which was the medical center of the world at that time, wrote his doctoral dissertation on the causes and therapy for chronic drunkenness, which is what it was called then. And he wrote a therapy which is still good today. You know, ordinarily, between the time when science finds some sort of solution to a problem and it becomes knowledge among the public, there's a cultural lag of about 20 years. But because of the blindness, the ignorance, and the stigma around alcoholism, it's been between 2,000 and 150 years, and we're still lagging. Well, I think it's because for hundreds of years now, we have made the mistake of treating this tripartite illness only one third at a time. Physically, or mentally, or morally. but never all three at once. The alcoholics in this room went to doctors time and again. And if they're like me, the doctors, with all honesty and best intention and to be helpful, he's just not understanding alcoholism, treated them physically if they were infertile. They filled them full of B1 shots, gave them sedation, kept them in the hospital or rest home, took away the shakes, restored their nutritional balance, filled them full of vitamins. And then they said to him, as my very good doctor, to whom I am to this day grateful, said to me, "Now, Dennis, hereafter just take one or two and then quit." And most doctors to this day still don't understand the illness of alcoholism. Hospitals don't. I had a doctor call me just week before last, about a man he had in his office. He said, "He's an alcoholic. We can't treat alcoholics." He called the Academy of Medicine. They said, "Send him to McGinnis, New York." Then he called me and said, "We can't treat alcoholics. Can I send him down to you?" I said, "Yes, do." The man came in. His wife was with him, his brother, a retired detective. He owns a store, he has two nice children. He didn't know what was wrong with him. He's never been a binge drinker, just cumulatively through the years drank more and more till he was saturated. And he didn't feel well, he was desperately sick. What was wrong? And the doctor sent him to me. Well, I put him in the AA ward up at Knickerbocker. And he came down with pneumonia and was dying. Out of a doctor's office. Because too many of them, don't understand the illness of alcoholism. And when they do what they do know, they treat the illness only physically. And they send the alcoholic from the hospital to the sanatorium or their offices back into the world from which this alcoholic came, still two-thirds ill, mentally and morally. Now, in the last several decades, we've had the great and wonderful therapies of psychiatry, for which, again, I am most grateful. But truthfully, and I'm not quoting McGinty now, I'm quoting the outstanding psychiatrists who have specialized in alcoholism, the traditional approaches of psychiatry will not work with the alcoholic. Specialized approaches have to be taken. Not necessarily a change in the psychiatric theory, but in the approach to the alcoholic. And that is why, for decades, psychiatrists have treated alcoholics and been unable to effect cure. The psychiatrists who specialize in alcoholism today don't say, "Now look, we'll not talk about your drinking, we're going back to the traumatic experiences of your childhood." With the alcoholic, they start here and now, with his problems as he is. And where did they learn this? Harry Thiebaud said to the American Psychiatric Association, "We learned this from AA, contrary to all psychiatric conditions. They started with the drinking, which we said was merely a symptom of the illness. And they're succeeding and we're failing. We must learn from them." An outstanding psychiatrist specializing in alcoholism, like Harold Lovell, Ruth Fox, Dr. Thiebaud, who write on the subject, this is what they say. This is what psychiatrists must learn, that the traditional approach must be different with alcoholics. Is it any wonder that psychiatrists diagnosed my clergyman friend as psychotic when they hadn't started with the approach which is necessary with alcoholics? A different approach. A starting here and now. And these same specialists say, "Our job is to help you all we can, then get you into AA." And so, for decades, We treated this illness, this three-part illness, one-third again, only mental. Slipped from the psychiatrist's couch or sanatorium, we sent the alcoholic back into the world, still two-thirds ill, physically and morally. Those who have been most patient with us, most compassionate, have been our clergy. But they too treated this illness only one-third at a time. They said to us, "Your sins are forgiven you. Go and sin no more." And there isn't an alcoholic in this room who didn't leave such a confessional resolve never again. Sincerely resolved. But he was still, though now morally free, physically and mentally ill. And so the long history of the illness, a tripartite illness, treated only one-third at a time. I would beg our psychiatrists to read the specialists in psychiatry, their own brothers, colleagues on alcoholism, Lovell, Fox, Thiebaud. I would beg the clergymen to read the great theologians like Ford on alcoholism and see the difference between the traditional approaches and the problem of the alcoholic. Where did they learn these things? They'll admit it. They learned it because alcoholics, abandoned in those back rooms of Uncle Ben, despaired of by doctors and hospitals and psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, prayed for by clergy, spurned by the community, discharged by the employer, despaired of by the family, finally themselves crawl to their knees and then to their feet and distilled out of their own bitter experience the 12 steps of AA, which treats this sick patient whole. Body, mind, and soul. But what happened? All over the world, 200,000 became arrested alcoholics, recovered alcoholics, and thank God, happy alcoholics. So that now, your Louisville paper today says, we need an ex-convict's anonymous. The papers say we need a divorcee's anonymous. We need a fatty's anonymous. We need a narcotic's anonymous. That's all right, it's wonderful. I'm sure our 12 steps would work for any problem anybody wants to apply. We're concerned with the alcoholic. Physically, it is the first drink. I talked to a group of doctors once. And I said, "How come you have other patients who on occasion drink and get drunk, but somehow they don't have to go on drinking until something or somebody helps them to stop? There must be something different about the alcoholic. Maybe there's something physiological." There's that school of physiologists who believe they'll still find out there is. Great research is going on all over the country, all over the world. I talked to a group of psychologists once at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I said to them, "I submit to you, gentlemen, that in the many combined years of your clinical counseling, there have come to you many non-alcoholics who were just as psychologically immature, just as emotionally unstable and overly sensitive as many of the alcoholics who came to you.
and even more so. And I'll submit that among them, there were those who on occasion drank and on occasion got drunk, but they did not have to go on drinking until something or somebody helped them to stop. I said to a group of clergymen, I submit to you, gentlemen, that in the many years of your combined pastoral counsel, there have come to your closet and your confessional many non-alcoholics, more immoral, more morally weak than many of the alcoholics who came to you. And among them were those who on occasion drank and on occasion got drunk, but they didn't have to go on drinking until something or somebody helped them to stop. Apart from the first drink, which somehow in the alcoholic sets up a need to go on drinking, apart from that first drink, alcoholics, look at them in the room about you, are no different, psychologically or morally, from anybody else. Except in this. That their illness was so gnarly, so messed, so discouraged, so defeating, that finally abandoned by community and all, they looked in the mirror and said, we've got to do something. And they did. God heard them. Because they cried De Profundis Clamavi. From the depths, they cried help. And the answer is AA. We are indeed the happy ones. I have heard it described in AA as a brotherhood of the second chance. There isn't anybody in this room who on many occasions hasn't said, oh, if I could only do it over again, if I only had another chance. Well, that's what we got today. A second chance. A second chance that says, don't take the first. That takes care of the physical illness. Take it easy. First things first, that helps the mental illness. Turn your mind and your will over to God as you understand them. Increase your daily conscious contact. That takes care of the first. Thus we treat the patient's hope. We have 12 steps. They're not an escalator. You don't get down at the bottom and ride to the top. Oh, no. You climb them carefully and slowly, 24 hours at a time, all the rest of your life. But they lead up and in. I remember when I was a bright young thing in college, I wrote a maxim once. It had a horrible title. It was called Maxim on the Relativity of Purpose or the Neutrality of Matter. Isn't that awful? Now, all it meant was this. This was the maxim. The maxim was simple. It is in the strange nature of a stairway that it leads both up and in or down and out. Our 12 steps is our stairway. And we know. And we're in this room, and all over the world is proof that if in the relativity of our purpose, we embrace this program, we can climb it up and in to sobriety, to our measure of sanity, and to the hope of eventual serenity, peace of soul. But we also know, as our 12th step reminds us, that we have brothers and sisters still in exterior darkness who
whom we must carry the message, who even in this hour are going down and out, and some of them may be in this room now. Some of them are home in Uncle Ben's back room now. And a brother or a sister or a mother or a father or an employer is in this room now to find out what he can learn to help. That's why we invite you here. Well, here it is, Sunday afternoon, February 19th, the room is full, including our fifth state Kentucky AA conference. We invite you all here, the public, relatives, friends, loved ones, the community at large. And just like alcoholics, what do? We get up and talk about ourselves. Therefore, I'm wondering if my alcoholic colleagues in the room would mind if for the next few minutes I were to step out of my personality as an AA and into my professional role as a social psychologist and see if there's anything we can do about two poorly integrated personalities who have only one head. We've got our program. We've got our 12 steps. And there you are with your poorly integrated personality. Stuck with it. Now, mind you, you may say you don't have any problems. And there's the difference between you and us. Alcoholics have to be honest with themselves, or they ain't going to get well. Now, what do you think alcoholics were looking for? They were looking for the same thing that all human beings look for, an escape from pain. They were looking for pleasure. I don't mean pleasure in the self-indulgent sense. I mean in the sense of well-being. Possibly because of some physiological susceptibility to the intake of alcoholic beverages, in a painful world they couldn't face, they found this as an escape from pain and a kind of a dream world of pleasure, they thought. This is what all human beings are looking for, an escape from unhappiness to happiness. So how about you people, you other people? Well, I looked back through my notes, and I found some brief report on an old study about how to be happy. This has nothing to do with alcoholics. It has nothing to do with alcoholism. It was done by a social psychologist named Hornell Hart, Dr. Hornell Hart at Duke University. I think even before the beginnings of AA. And it was an effort to find the scientific answer for human beings. And may I remind you, and especially the AA, that we are human beings too. We have headaches and corns and all kinds of things like other human beings. Now, this is the way science went about. Got a group of psychiatric social workers, and they interviewed thousands of people who might be called happy people, psychologically mature, emotionally stable, happy. And they set down all the reasons these people gave for why they were happy, why they thought they were happy. Then they went through and they selected out those reasons given which recurred in all of them. Each person has unique reasons for happiness, but when something everybody said recurred and recurred, they said,
This must be one of the keys to happiness. We'll set this one aside. Then they interviewed thousands of what we may call unhappy people. Psychologically immature. Emotionally unstable. And they get unhappy people. And they set down all the reasons they did. Now, people all have their unique reasons for unhappiness. So they selected out those that recurred in all of them. And they said, these must be the keys to unhappiness. Now we'll put these together, and we'll have a scientifically arrived at answer for how to be happy, how to avoid unhappiness. After all of those interviews, how many keys, precepts, principles, steps, mate, you think they found? 9. Only 9. We got 12. That ain't bad for 2 heads. So briefly, for the sake of our guests, with the indulgence of my fellow AAs, I'd like to see what we could say for you people, so you too can have a second chance to integrate your personality. 1. Mind you, this has nothing to do with alcoholism or alcoholics. This is about human beings. 1. Shun suspicion and resentment. Nursing a grudge has been found to pull down happiness levels an average of 50%. Now, those of you who know a little bit about AA know we do an awful lot of talking about not bearing grudges or resentments. Oh, I think you can have a resentment. Spit it out, get it out of your system, forget about it. Don't nurse it. But it seems that human beings do this. Not just alcoholics. And that it pulls down their happiness 50%. How many in this room are still resenting? The days when the alcoholic before the alcoholic was in AA. How many in this room are still resenting that other woman in the church guild? The neighbor who did this. Every moment you spend preoccupied with some bitter resentment is a moment you could be spending being grateful to God for some happiness. Well, 2. Live in the present and the future 24 hours at a time. Now mind you, this has nothing to do with AA or alcoholism at all. This is science talking to human beings and saying, here's what you do if you want to be happy and avoid unhappiness. Most unhappiness, most of it, stems from an unwholesome preoccupation with our own mistakes and failures of the past. These are important only as our passport to a better and wiser today. Forgive yourself. Please. This is as vital to your happiness as forgiving others. Now I know that this is one of the toughest things in AA. For alcoholics to learn to forgive themselves for the past. But it seems that human beings have to do this too. And if you are honest, as we must be honest, it means that you in this room, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, have this problem. To learn to forgive yourself. Why don't you? Pride. Pride. You forgive others, Explain, oh, I understand how you could have done that. It's gone, it's past, it's over with. I know how it happened. I can see these things. All of us do this. And then we retreat within our own little cell of pride, and we can't forgive ourselves for the same thing we forgive somebody else. No, beautiful me couldn't do that. Sure, that harmless poor soul could, and I forgive him. But gorgeous, beautiful me, I cannot forgive myself. That's pride. The community forgives. Our clergy forgives. Our loved ones forgive. God and Jesus crucified forgive us. And we're too damn proud to forgive ourselves. Be honest. Try that for heaven. Number three, don't waste time and energy fighting conditions you cannot save. We in AA have a little prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Well, it seems that science says human beings have this problem. Science says there's little you personally can do about stopping a war, healing the incurable disease of a loved one, or changing the nature of those with whom you live. So stop hurling yourself against stone walls. You know, one of the many complex reasons for which I drank was because of a certain sensitivity I had. Maybe some of you noticed that I'm kind of short. I suffered with it. I spent hours and years envying those who were tall. It wasn't funny. It was painful. As a kid, I never went through a door but I'd jump and hang on it, hoping I'd stretch myself to be a little taller. You can laugh, but think of a young kid trying to do that to get tall. Well, I came into AA, and they told me to accept things I couldn't change. So I kind of figured, well, that's it, McGindy. Oh, they told me, if you keep coming to meetings, work the program, you'll be surprised how everything will work out for you. And I figured, yeah, all but that one. So I kind of accepted it. Funny thing, it even got to where I'd forget I was short months at a time. Except when I'd go and register at some hotel, when I got to the room, all I could see was the top of my head, the shade, the mirrors way up there. A few little tricks I could tell plumbers, too. Well, I accept. I accept. I didn't like it. But somehow, through God's grace, I began to turn my mind from this envy and resentment of others who had height. And I began to discover that God was all just. He hadn't given me height. Through my father and mother, he's given me a pretty good mind that I'd been taking for granted. I began to be grateful for the things he gave me. Gratitude is a happy thing. I suggest to you
Find the thing you can be grateful for. Maybe you have to wear glasses and it bothers you. But you may have beautiful hair. Some of you, I noticed, ain't got so much hair. But maybe you've got good teeth. Maybe you don't have to wear glasses. Every moment we spend feeling sorry for ourselves, resenting, envying, feeling deprived for something somebody else has, is a moment we could be being happy and grateful for what God gave us. This is what science says that human beings should do to escape pain and to find happiness. I was talking about my being short. I accept it. I went on going to meetings. One day I went to a meeting and a fellow who hadn't been in that group, I'd never seen him before, came back for a visit. A big tall fellow. As we were going out, one of the guys said, "Gee, doesn't Hugo look good? You know, I believe he's even taller." I said, "You think maybe if I keep coming to meetings?" You know, the next week I went down to the meeting. We met in the 19th floor of a skyscraper in Chicago. The plane stopped about the 8th floor. A fella got on that I had heard my first year in AA. He had a great shock of white hair. And he stood up at a podium like this when he talked. And he seemed such a great, mammoth, tall man. And I think I saw him for the first time that day. He got on and he said, "Hi, Mac." And I didn't even answer. He must have thought I was nuts. I said to him, "Say, Clem, you're not tall, are you?" He said, "Hell no, whoever said I was." I left the meeting and another fellow came in. He said, "Hi, Mac." And I said, "Ned, you're not tall, are you?" He said, "Hell no, I'm just fat." I had been seeing people tall. I had what the psychiatrist called a selective sensitivity. So strangely, because I've accepted what I can't change, I'll admit I'm not getting any taller. But all you people are getting shorter. So they were right. This program works. And science says it can work for you. I heard an AA tell a story a couple of weeks ago in Washington. A fella felt his cross, like I felt my being short was. It was too great for him to carry. He couldn't carry it any farther. So he went to Jesus and he said, "Jesus, I can't carry this cross any farther. I beg you, give me a smaller cross. This is the best I can do." And he said, "All right, I'll let you pick your own cross. Come with me." And he took him over the hillside and down the road to peace. There was a whole field, as far as the eye could see, planted with crosses. Tall crosses, little crosses. Slender crosses and stout crosses. Crooked crosses and straight crosses. Crosses of all sizes and descriptions as far as the eye could see. Jesus said, "Go, pick your own cross." And the man walked up and down every aisle and crossed and dashed. And finally, way over in the middle, in a corner, far corner, he found a little cross. He said, "I'll take that one." And Jesus said, "Well, that's the one
you've been carrying all the time. Accept the things you cannot change. I heard somebody say once that to believe in God is to say yes to life. How often we say no and make ourselves unhappy. Number five, when you find yourself in the grip of emotional stress, force yourself to be outgoing to others instead of retreating within yourself and building a prison of love. Every alcoholic in this room knows that prison of love. In the most crowded bar, sober in the hearts of our family, we suffered from utter loneliness. Science says that human beings do this. And that when they do, they should, as our 12th step tells us, not retreat, but go and find someone to help. Don't weep because you have no shoes. Remember the man who has no feet. Well, number six from science's 9 steps for happiness. Refuse to pity yourself or seek self-justification in easy alibis that make you appear noble to yourself or others. Think that one over. Mind you, this has nothing to do with AA. How often we human beings sit around home being misunderstood, blaming conditions in life and somebody else because we don't want to accept our own responsibility. Science says that human beings do this, and they should avoid the easy alibi. How many of us may be telling a litany of nobility to ourselves for the years when we lived with an alcoholic? Reliving its unhappiness, wallowing in self-pity, destroying the happy hour we could be having. Number seven. Here is cold, analytical, secularized, non-value judgment science saying, cultivate the old-fashioned virtues of love, honor, courtesy, loyalty, thrift, and church attendance, of all things. Science says, old-fashioned. What is old-fashioned? The old-fashioned, something's got to be old. To be old, it's got to work or it wouldn't be around. For it to work, it must be compatible with God's natural law for the world, or it'll go out of whack. I have sociological colleagues who say that when a thing gets old enough, it becomes sacred. They got the cart before the horse. Up in the 20s. You remember them? We used to call ourselves emancipated. I think it was William Lyon Phelps who said we weren't emancipated, we were just unbuttoned. And we thought all of these things were old-fashioned. Yet here science says they are important to human happiness. Makes me think of a story they used to tell. The young soldier during World War I got scared. Fear is something we all know. And the veil of tears in the battle of life. Fear.
We want to run away, not just alcoholic human beings. We want this cup to pass from us. So this young soldier started back, and he met old Black Jack Pershing. Pershing said, "Where are you going, soldier?" He said, "I'm scared, I'm going back." Pershing said, "No, you're not. Listen, son," he said, "I'm scared too." The soldier said, "Oh, no, you're not. You've got courage." He said, "Son, courage is just fear that has said its prayer." So try the old-fashioned person if you would be happy. Number 8, stop expecting too much of yourself. When there's too wide a gap between the standards you set for yourself and your actual achievement, unhappiness is inevitable. If you can't improve your performance, lower your standards instead. If you can't be chairman of the committee, you can still serve on it. If you can't be the center of the thing, you still can be in the act. How often we do this? We go away and sulk unless we can have our way, run the show. In home, at the office, at the club. If we can't be the top, well, every moment spent regretting again is moments you could be spending enjoying. I heard it said that ambition is the courage to pursue the things you want, whereas happiness is the surrender to enjoy the things you have. So many of us are so busy pursuing, we have no time for the happiness of being. Well, you will have noticed, if you hark back to our 12 steps of AA as Carl read them, but there's something we AAs make an awful lot of in our 12 steps for happiness that science hasn't mentioned yet. We talk about turning our minds and our wills over to God. God's restorative to sanity, increasing our daily conscious contact. Well, you'd hardly expect science to talk about something like that. This is faith. And yet, I have one step left. And this is number 9. Find something bigger than yourself in which to believe. Self-centered, materialistic, this worldly people score lowest on Duke University's test for measuring happiness, while those who average high in altruism, spiritual values, and religious attitudes generally come up with the top happiness rate. Well, there you have it. 9 steps to happiness, given to you by science, so that you too may have a brotherhood of a second chance. And I submit to you that it seems miraculous that science talking about human beings should have set down 9 steps, which are practically the 12 steps Alcoholics Anonymous, the forgotten malady, the hidden patient, who out of his own bitter experience wrote these things down himself. I submit it is a miracle. When I was young, studying Bible history,
We were told that God performed miracles to prove or reassure his power to men. And that he still does.
You know what a miracle is? I heard about an old Irish lady had been over to the shrine at Lourdes. And when she came back, she was stopped at the customs, and they said to her, "What have you got anything to declare?" She said, "Nothing at all." "What have you got in that bottle?" "Oh," she said, "there's nothing at all. But a little holy water from the shrine at Lourdes." "Holy water, you say? Let me smell of it." "Uh-huh. Whiskey it is."
"Whiskey, you say? Glory be to God. It's a miracle."
If you look up miracle in the dictionary, it will say that a miracle is something that happens outside the expected laws of nature. It cannot be explained by the laws, physical laws of science. It can be explained only by the intervention of a divine power. Now, there are shrines here in the Occident and shrines at the holy places of the Orient. For the lame, the halt, and the blind have come to holy places, been cured, recovered, and often the recovery is a learning to live with their illness, a saying yes to life. And they have left there as proof of their recovery, crutch, restraint, braces, climbing to the ceiling to the holy places. Well, there are alcoholics in this room. Doctors gave them up. Psychiatrists here. Families were defeated. Communities clucked their tongues. Employers regretted. But no. Yes, through AA, and its belief in a higher power, somehow miracle happens. Sitting next to you today in this room is a man or woman who for years could not walk without glass crutches. Sitting next to you today in this room is a man or woman whose bedside you visited, and there were restraints there. They knew needles of sedation. They knew the palsy and the shakes of the Old and the New Testament. And a miracle happened. The recovery. The laughter you hear in this room is the echo of a miracle of tears they shed. I submit to you that we could build our own shrine metaphorically, leaving in the corner of this flag room today, piled to the ceiling, the glass touches of the past, the restraints, the needles, the tears. Science wants facts. If you came here because you have an Uncle Ben at home in a room, or a neighbor, or someone in the next apartment, or across the street, or down in the other 40, and every one of us has somebody where our lives touch upon their alcoholism. If you came here, see what you can learn, and you'll hear us talking about this God business, and you're skeptical, and you wanted a scientific answer, and I give you a scientific answer. Facts are scientific, and there are sitting all around you, living, breathing, happy facts of the miracle of recovery in AA. And there are 200,000 of them
all over the world. Are you still skeptical? Then I say to you, for your own brotherhood of a second chance, or ours, do you call it superstition? We talk here. Look at the facts around. From ancient days, the symbols came, the sign, the amulet, the charm, the seal, the ring, a name to conjure with and shoot from heart. Faith in and dread of all these things is one of man's great racial quirks. But down through time, the question rings, is this superstition? When it works,